Topic for this retreat, clear comprehension, is an English translation of an ancient Indian Buddhist concept, sampajana. If this idea had been discovered, this concept, this state, this had been discovered in modern United States, and they had someone chosen a modern concept to describe it, given what people have been saying, words, concepts that are popular in the last few years, they might have called it a superpower. These are four superpowers. These are ways of accomplishing phenomenal things in this life. To have a clear sense of purpose, people accomplish phenomenal things. Once a person really knows what's important, what's valuable, what they really want to dedicate themselves to, people can accomplish just about anything. Without a clear sense of purpose, some people are adrift. Without a clear sense of purpose, some people are victims of clickbait. There are people who have paid a lot of money to bait you, to bait your attention. There's lots of discussion now about strategies of distraction on the web and the computer, and the mind jumping around and not being settled and surfing from one thing to the other. And not a few people have spent a lot of wasted time surfing on the web. If the clear sense of purpose was to surf on Pacific coast waves, I'm sure that person would be a lot happier with their life than if the clear sense of purpose was to surf the web. Very different engagement, very different participation, very different involvement with life. And it's a sad life when we get our attentions get dispersed too easily. And there's a way in which being dispersed and distracted and jumping around from one thing to the other can be energy draining, tiring. And there's something very different when there's a clear sense of purpose and our energy gets coordinated, gets gathered together. Our energies get undistracted. And it could actually be energizing. It can be enlivening, like things could become our life force. All the things get coordinated and work together and build rather than draining and scattering. And so to have a clear sense of purpose is can be one of the great things in life. And the art of it is to have a clear sense of purpose of something that is, in fact, beneficial, nourishing, healthy. Some people have the clear sense of purpose to be as wealthy as they possibly can. And with enough dedication and luck, some people are successful. But they're probably not happy. Someone else has a clear sense of purpose. There's a person I know, I used to know, who lived a relatively poor life. But I always thought this person was wealthy because the person thought they were completely satisfied and happy and had plenty, was satisfied with the life, but was so generous, so kind, so present for friends and neighbors and people. Had so little fear. Never locked their front door. Never locked their car door. In fact, would roll down the window a little bit so that if someone wanted to break into the car, at least they wouldn't break the window. And went through the life with this kind of generosity and lightness and ease that I thought made the person quite wealthy. So the person had a purpose or had values or something, way of being, that was central to the person's life and organized and directed how the person went about life around the values, these values that the person had. It was kind of a superpower. Suitability, clear comprehension of suitability, the superpower of appropriateness, is to know what is suitable for the purpose we have. So, for example, using an ancient analogy, if your purpose is to get olive oil, don't squeeze gravel. It's not suit. You won't get olive oil squeezing gravel. If you want olive oil, squeeze olives. So there has to be some sense of knowing what's appropriate, what does the work, what's useful. Many people have felt that they wanted to be involved in Dharma practice, Buddhism, and spent decades only reading about it. And there might have been some value in that. I don't want to dismiss the value. But, maybe if you squeeze apricot pits, maybe you get a little bit of apricot juice, but you don't get much. So if you squeeze those Dharma books, that's all you do, you might get a little bit of Dharma. But to compare to practicing, really sitting, it's a whole different thing. There was a Dharma teacher in England in the 1960s, part of the Buddhist English establishment of the time. And he'd done a lot of book learning and knew a lot about Buddhism and was very enthusiastic about it. And he would go around England giving lectures about Buddhism to proper functions. And then in the middle of one of his own lectures, giving it to it, it was like lightning struck. And it occurred to him that if he really believed all these things, he should practice. And so he immediately got a ticket for Thailand and became a monk and went there and started practicing. He'd been teaching about Buddhism for a long time. And then he just suddenly realized, what am I doing? He went to practice. So book learning only goes so far. So to know what's appropriate and what's appropriate for the purpose you have, there's so many conditions that contribute to answering the question. Some of it has to do with you, your nature, your capacity, your abilities, your circumstances. No two people are alike. Some of it has to do with the circumstances you find yourself in. When this person in England decided to get serious about practice, I don't think there was really any serious practice places in England in the early 60s. There might have been one little place, a Sri Lankan temple or something. I don't know how You know, there wasn't that much, but now if you go to England, there's like lots of centers all over the country. And you don't have to go to Thailand anymore. It's suitable, perhaps, to stay in England. So, you know, what's suitable? What are the circumstances that makes it suitable for us? What's appropriate? So I think that one of the great tasks of human life is to really spend time reflecting on purpose, intention, what's most important for us, and to get some clarity around that. And something like meditation practice, like retreat practice, can be a wonderful place to start getting clarity, because it's a way of dropping a lot of the extra preoccupations of the mind, the divisions of the mind, the scatteredness of the mind and heart, and getting somehow settled enough, organized enough inside of us to begin seeing with new eyes and seeing perhaps what's important for us. What is important? And I think everyone will probably decide, I hope everyone decides this for themselves, and it could be infinite possibilities. I think that there's a little bit of neurosis, at least in the modern parts of America that I'm in touch with, around putting too much emphasis on career, like finding the right career, doing the right thing. And that's, some people find that, and it's very nice. I was inspired by a man I met recently who was doing some kind of, I'm going to tell you, he was in charge of installing an electric door opener for the door at IMC. And the electrical door opener that they installed was probably not suitable in some people's ears for a meditation center by the amount of noise it made when it opened, grinding noise. So we called the people up and said that to them. And he was unfailingly kind, friendly, generous, happy, at ease. And it, you know, I had lots of contact with him, went to his warehouse and tried out a more quiet one. And I was so struck by his goodness, his generosity, his spirit of kindness. I don't know what his purpose in life is, but I thought, well, this is a worthwhile organizing principle for our life. I think, you know, certainly it can be a, I imagine it can be a purpose of someone's life to help people open doors. But to have the purpose of the life be these wonderful qualities of kindness and friendliness and generosity. To have that be the organizing principle for a life rather than a career. I think some people who have careers would be better off doing door opener service if it was done in that way that he did it. So what's most important? Spend time reflecting on it, thinking about it. And I, you know, this is an experienced student's retreat. So I think that, I hope that being an experienced student means something. I assume that it means that a person has done a fair amount of retreats. And I don't take that lightly. It's difficult to do retreats. It's difficult to have the time to do retreats, to have the motivation. And I think there's a, whether you recognize it or not, there's a sense of purpose, that this is valuable, this is important. There's so many things you can do in life, and you've chosen to do this. And then then you have the purpose to be on retreat, and then you can ask the question, what is suitable for you? What's appropriate for you to be on retreat? You know, people are not on a retreat center for this retreat, so the answer of what's appropriate and suitable is so circumstantial to each of you. But to not ask that question, at the beginning of the pandemic, there were some people who wanted to make their retreats, these online retreats from home, be exactly like being at a retreat center. You know, and to have exactly the same schedule and the wake up, and everything was supposed to be just like, you know, make it just like how it's supposed to be. And I don't think it worked for any of them to do it that way. It's like fighting reality. Usually reality wins. So the idea is to be in harmony with it, or do it in a way that's suitable and appropriate. So what's the criteria for that? The criteria is what supports you, helps you not to do the retreat as an abstract kind of schedule and thing, but what supports you to get more settled? What supports you to develop your metta? What supports you to be not just concerned for your own practice, but feel like you're part of a community and you have something to offer in how you practice, how you show up? Maybe it's appropriate for you to clean up your room a little bit more. Maybe then it's easier for you to get settled and feel when you show up. And maybe if people see your room around you, maybe you think that, well, maybe it supports other people to not see chaos, but to see something that has some sense of order or peace or cleanliness or something. So what's suitable? What's suitable for the purposes you have for being on retreat? And if the purpose of retreat is to become freer, so you're not caught in greed or hatred or delusion, not caught in attachments, not caught up in self, me, myself, and mine, what supports that? So one thing that supports it is to be in harmony with your environment, to not kind of try to some hard and fast way seal yourself off from the world around you and protect your precious practice at all costs and kind of get stiff or strict or in some way that, rather than helping you settle, helps you become more brittle, helps you become more tight and uptight maybe. I've known people who have been uptight on retreat because of their precious practice they had. They didn't want anybody to disturb it. When I was practicing in the retreat center in Burma, there was a man like that. And I just arrived at the retreat center. He'd already been there for a while. And so I had a simple question for him about something, about being, you know, we were very few Westerners there and didn't speak the language. And so maybe I asked him where the shower is or something. And he has looked at me and growled and said, I'm on retreat. And I said, oh, okay. So, okay. And I learned that in the many months we were there practicing, he was miserable. He never got settled. And I wondered if there was some connection between those two things, that his pushing me away and trying to hold on to his practice in such a dear way was one of the factors, maybe, that was the very attitude that was maybe preventing something to settle. What's appropriate? What's an appropriate way to be on retreat? in this kind of lineage that we're in, practicing in, which is the Mahasi lineage of practice, there's a very strong ethos that there are no distractions. It's just one other thing to be mindful of. In the first group Vipassana retreat that I witnessed was my first time I went to practice in Bangkok. I ended up visiting one of the large monasteries in Bangkok. And there was a big kind of apartment building almost, you can imagine. And there was this big lobby with stairs going up to this, to the other floors. In this big lobby, there was a big wooden desk with a telephone. And there was a monk behind the desk and would receive people as they came in and tell them where to go and would answer the phone and yell out to different people. And there's all these people coming and going up and down the steps and talking loud and all this activity, commotion. And then there under the steps going up, the steps kind of curved up. So underneath the steps, there was the first Vipassana retreat I saw in the lobby. And there were about 15 people sitting there with a teacher. And they were sitting there meditating while all this commotion was going on around them. That was their retreat. And they seemed pretty peaceful and quiet. So this idea and this Mahasi practice, you practice with what you have. I think it's okay to go and practice in quiet places, away from the hustle and bustle, the lobbies of monasteries. But the principle of what's appropriate, it's not appropriate or suitable to be tight holding on to practice. It's not suitable to be pushing it away, being greedy. There's an ease and a relaxation and kind of willingness to work with whatever's going on, to be fluid, adaptable. So I'm using this as these examples of this principle of a reflective life, a life that is contemplative, that's reflective about what's going on. And so we reflect on the purpose and we reflect on what is suitable, what's appropriate, what supports that purpose. And we can have, as Inez said, we can have kind of a core purpose. And then to fulfill that core purpose, we do other things which support the secondary purposes or tertiary purposes. But they're all organized around the primary one. So if the primary purpose for a Dharma practitioner is to become free of a mind and heart that is held captive to desires, to aversion, to fear, to selfishness, to become free of suffering. What secondary purposes support that? Living by the ethical precepts, cultivating loving kindness, going on retreat, living when it's appropriate, a reflective life, meaning that to really contemplate and consider deeply and think things out and understand yourself better. And then there's probably tertiary. But it's an example of a organizing principle that coordinates everything else. So we're not scattered. We're dispersed with our energies. And that's one of the benefits of going on retreat. For the week of the retreat, we can organize ourselves around a particular purpose much more thoroughly than we can in everyday life. So there's a thoroughness, continuity, and engagement. And then what's appropriate? At IRC, we have an agreement when we come that to not use technology, computers, smartphones and stuff like that, because we found that it actually works better for the mind to be off the devices. And it's also, we have a society of people who have an addiction to their devices. And so it supports people who are really struggling with this to have a community of people who are abstaining. So we ask people to come to IRC to abstain. And then as soon as the pandemic started, we are one of the enablers of being on your device. You know, it's kind of a little bit of a paradox. But circumstances change. And so it might not be, these online retreats might not be the best place to break an addiction to technology. But maybe it's okay, because it has other purposes, it has other values at this time. Or maybe it is a great place. If you're on your laptop or your computer, it's in front of you, and the Dharma talk and suitability of purpose is getting a little bit boring or irritating, maybe it's just so easy, like the hand can slide up and check, I could check an email. I can listen to this. I can probably do both. This talk is not that dense. Like I'll check emails, or even better, I'll check the news, and I'll do both. So, but not to do that, to have a clear sense of purpose and suitability. It's not suitable when you're in retreat to start dividing your attention. It's good to stay present. And if the talk is not so interesting, then at least don't divide the attention. Maybe just sit up straighter, close your eyes, and just listen to the sound of the talk. Forget the words and what they mean. I've gotten quite concentrated listening to Dharma talks. When they were over, I had no idea what was said. But it was really good because of this wonderful concentration stillness that came in. Sometimes I got more still during retreats listening to the talk than I actually could on my own. So it's kind of nice. So what does it mean to be an experienced practitioner on experienced practitioner's retreat? I don't know. I don't want to answer that question for you. But I do know that people begin discovering things through this practice that become valuable for them. People discover what it's like to have a non-scattered mind, a non-fragmented presence, being. People discover how good it is to be settled on oneself, relaxed and calm and settled, rather than unsettled. But somehow the very energies or sensations of the body scattered or uplifted in a way that feels imbalanced. Compulsive sensations and feeling coursing through the body. And to discover how clean it feels or healthy it feels to be settled and peaceful. Or people discover that they've been so mean in their mind, so angry or so caught up in desires. And they realize, you know, that I don't want to live that way anymore. It's hard not to, but I know well enough that this is not the way to go. So it becomes a very strong negative purpose. Not that anymore. I don't want to suffer that way anymore. Sometimes people discover qualities of inner goodness or compassion, inner sense of freedom, inner spiritual health, inner capacity to empathize with the world, that can feel like this is valuable. This is more important for me. I can't think of anything that's more important. Or to say it differently, in the way I said it for myself, there was a time in my practice where, after I'd been in the monastery for a while, I felt, you know, nothing is that important for me anymore. But the most important thing is the Dharma, is the practice. So I don't know what you think of that. I don't even know what I think of that, but, you know, nothing is that important anymore, but what was most important was Dharma. And so what happens as people continue in this Dharma practice? And I will keep on stressing, I don't want to say it's this way for everyone, but sooner or later, I think, in order for this practice to be sustainable and something that you want to make it really an integral part of your life, you've discovered something. You discovered a way of being, or you discovered certain values, or you discovered what not to do. That becomes, more important than anything else. I've known people who have said that the Dharma, the practice, is even more important than their spouse. They might not tell that to their spouse so directly, but more important than their spouse. But because of the practice, they love their spouse more. So what does a spouse want? To be the most important thing, but less loved? Or to let you have the Dharma be the most important and to be loved more? To be more present or something. So, but, you know, to make the Dharma most central. But what is the Dharma? And I think the Dharma are some of these things I'm talking about. It's certain values that you discover, certain freedoms you discover, certain states of being, compassion, love, care, that you discover. It's discovering, and this is actually a very important discovery, it's discovering what doesn't work, discovering what's not valuable anymore, discovering at some point that complaining as a profession almost is not so good. Discovering that gossiping. I've had a lot of people come to me who work in settings where over the coffee machine or the water cooler, the exchange of conversation is gossip. And they don't want to do it anymore. They find it's very hard then to be in harmony with their fellow workers when the exchange was gossip and they no longer want to be participating in that. No longer want to be part of, they realize that greed doesn't work anymore. One of the great things that I discovered is that being selfish doesn't work anymore. Being self-centered doesn't work. we have a society, I think, that validates selfishness, that supports being self-centered, that supports making you the center of your preoccupation. We have these messages that we're supposed to be a certain way, and then we're preoccupied by how to cope with that seeming demand from society around us. But it's an amazing thing to discover that it doesn't work to be self-centered. It doesn't work to organize a life around me, myself, and mine. But what else is there if that doesn't work? And some people discover that's other things that work. Some people will say that what works is to put the Dharma in the center. And life is organized around a purpose that is an alternative to selfishness or self-centeredness. An alternative to greed and hatred. An alternative to even being afraid. And then when this clear sense of purpose becomes a superpower, then there's a strength. Then we've discovered an inner capacity that becomes a strength that sees us through the many myriad of challenges that life presents, that our psychology presents, that our experiences in life present. But to meet them with strength, and that sense of this is a purpose, and then to meet it also with the ability to ask the question, what's appropriate here? What's suitable for this purpose? What's suitable to find a way here? And how that's a superpower is it frees us from the idea that there's a right way. Frees us from the idea that there's only one way or the way to do it. And so it can start being a fluidity and a creativity and a adaptability to work with circumstances. And if someone says, no, it's only one way, you can say, well, we'll see. We'll find out. What's suitable for living a life that's not self-centered, not selfish? I can imagine there's all kinds of magazines you probably shouldn't be reading. I can imagine that hanging on to every word, to every little suggestion, every nuance, every image, every little glitter in a teeth whitening advertisement is not the way to overcome selfishness. So these are maybe silly examples, but I think the principle is here. It's like, what supports it? What's appropriate? So a superpower of clear comprehension of purpose. And then once you have it, you set your course. This is what I'm doing. Maybe you have other purposes as well, but if you have too many purposes, we become scattered. A wise life of someone who's reflective and attentive to what's going on in this world, a wise person would has to decide which good cause to let go of. There's just too many good things to do, important things to do. And then we don't do one of them really well. One of the principles that I've kind of come to appreciate is that if you do one thing really well, your life might get narrow for a while. But then at some point, when you kind of have some degree of mastery, the world opens up in whole new ways that you can participate in society in ways you never imagined before. I remember a long time ago when there was ping pong diplomacy, you know, that the Chinese-American diplomatic relations opened up in 1960s during the Nixon administration. When American ping pong team went to China to play in competition, that was like the opening of this relationship between these two countries. Those ping pong players never would have imagined they were going to have such a historical role. But they just kind of were dedicated to ping pong. They probably had a strong sense of purpose. But look what it opened up to for them. So Dharma practice is like that as well. To really dig down and do it well. And then wisely let go of things that are, if you can't really follow through very well, if you do too many good things. But then you go in and then it opens up again at some point. The Dharma always will turn you inside out and open to the world. And this superpower, then suitability, what's suitable? What supports you for the purpose you have? What's appropriate? And if one of the guiding principles that you've learned is important, is not to be attached, not to cling to things. Then when you're looking for what's suitable, you have that as a protection. That you're not stuck in one way, it has to be one way. But you are adaptable and you're finding your way. And after a while, you discover that in that very adaptability is where the freedom is. So traditionally, this idea of suitability has a lot to do with discovering what kinds of practices are suitable given what's happening. Sometimes it's appropriate to do mindfulness, sometimes loving kindness. Sometimes it's appropriate to be on retreat. Sometimes it's more appropriate to practice in the world. Sometimes it's more appropriate to do study. Sometimes it's more appropriate to do less study. And so over a lifetime, what's appropriate in practice varies depending on the phases of our life, the phases of our practice. And so to be tuning in to this question, what's suitable now? What's supportive? Where's the opening? Where's the nourishment? Where's the growth? Dharma growth. So, for this retreat, just maybe, without having some big important purpose, but is there some kind of purpose that you have for this retreat that helps you to get organized and focused? Something that helps you put things aside which are not supportive. Something that gives you a superpower of being dedicated and devoted. Yes. To cultivate my mindfulness. To get settled and concentrated in my mindfulness, or to cultivate the mindfulness and discover what is it Gil talks about, that there are no distractions in mindfulness. What does that mean? I'm going to really buckle down and really see. And what's suitable with that purpose? What supports it? And what might support it is to get the mind quieter and stiller. What's supportive is maybe to live simpler. Maybe it can be as simple as what's suitable is if you have to make meals for yourself, to make less elaborate meals, to keep it really simple. So what allows you to get settled, focused, committed, dedicated, so that it's kind of like everything who you are that's scattered gets unified, gets pulled together? What purpose of the retreat would be useful for you to have to support you to get more still, more focused, more, more absorbed in the simple steps you take when you do walking meditation? If you are spreading butter on your toast, what's the appropriate way of putting butter on the toast that supports the purpose of the retreat? To really be right there. So by the time the butter is spread on the toast, you're stiller and quieter and more focused than you were before. Perhaps that sense of purpose and discovering what's suitable can be applied in all the different things you're doing through the day. So you have lunch, and what's suitable after lunch? What supports all this? Maybe it's very mindfully laying down for a nap. Maybe it's mindfully going to a place where you can look out the window and just let go and watch the trees. Maybe what's suitable is to finish your lunch and go back onto your cushion and sit. Because any other option you could think of means your mind's going to get busier. And it's just simpler and nicer to keep it simple. So all through the day, you can ask yourself the question, what's suitable, what's appropriate to support the overall purpose I have for this retreat? Without getting stressed, without getting tense because you're trying too hard. What's supportive to keep you relaxed? So there's room in your heart for it to sing, for it to express its delight and joy in living a Dharma life. So this is living a reflective life in service and the purpose of mindfulness. And one shorthand that I like to use for this is a reflective life that helps quiet the thinking. Quieter and quieter, stiller and stiller. And so everything becomes unified. Here, now, just this, just here, is where the Dharma is found. So simple, so present. And so instructive for what's important in this life. So may you delightfully give yourself over a little bit more to the purpose you have for being on this retreat. Thank you.